Today, we're continuing in our series on the big questions of life. And we come to one today that's really important. It might sound like, oh, no, you know, that's not going to be interesting. But I think you'll find it very interesting. We're talking about this. Is the biblical ethic of work essential for my life? The biblical ethic of work. We Christians are kind of famous for our work ethic. And the question comes up, do we have to do that? I mean, society is changing. We have automation. We have talk about universal basic income. What do we really have to be so, you know, diligent, industrious all the time? Do we have to? And the answer is, yeah, you pretty much do. But here's why. We're going to look at two reasons. The first reason is your personal well-being and sometimes even survival is directly tied to your work ethic, to your diligence, to your hard effort. And secondly, your ability to love God and others is directly tied to this same thing, your own hard work. It affects your love for God and others. And that's never going to go away because of automation, etc. Here's a newsflash. Life is hard. All of you who've been around the block, you know that life is hard. You're not surprised to hear this, but sometimes we Americans forget that life is hard, routinely hard. Most people have a really, really hard time in life. And you have to brace for that because that's the reality. Jordan Peterson, who talks about work ethic from time to time, says, throughout history, men and women both struggled terribly for freedom from the overwhelming horrors of deprivation and necessity. I mean, he's talking about hardship. And by the way, he's a clinical psychologist, so I guess he should know something about people in hardship, right? In history, there's been this struggle for freedom from horrible things like deprivation, in addition to filth, misery, disease, starvation, cruelty, and ignorance that characterized the lives of both sexes before the 20th century, women also had to put up with the serious practical inconvenience of menstruation, the high probability of unwanted pregnancy, the chance of death or serious damage during childbirth and the raising of young children. Life is hard. Bad things can happen while you live life in this world. So here's the reality. For the whole history of the world, the vast majority of people could not hope to have both plenty of time and plenty of money. That's just not realistic. You will have to choose all of your life between these two. Do I want to have more time or want to have more money? And you have to pick one because you're probably not going to have plenty of time and plenty of money. Here's the reality. You could put in low effort and make a little bit of money, but there's a price to pay for that. So on the left-hand side there, if you just kind of chill, you're a bit of a slacker, but you have lots of free time. The pros to this, you know, not the cons, the pro, well, you'll enjoy lots of time for rest and play because you don't work much. So that's great. But here's the con. You will feel trapped, normally, in unattractive, high crime, high ignorance surroundings. Now, this would not be true of a trust fund baby. He's always going to have enough money. He can live where he wants to live. But that's not normal. Very few people are trust fund babies. For most of humanity, this is the reality. Low effort, little money means you are going to be trapped in an unattractive neighborhood. You're going to be trapped in a high crime area. And you are going to be trapped in high ignorance surroundings. You say, that's just so harsh. I mean, do you have to say it that way? But that's the reality. The third bullet point on the left side, you'll be colliding with the realities, and these are realities. You'll be colliding with the realities of poverty being strongly linked with physical and mental health disorders. We'll say more about that in a minute. Now, on the right-hand side, you'll notice you could have high effort. You could work hard, and you'll have more money. And by more money, we don't mean filthy rich. We mean just more money. It's still pretty hard for most people. In that case, you're going to have little time for rest and play. You'll be working hard enough that you don't have endless time for rest and play. But at least you are now going to have a way to escape what's on the left side, right? Still, the cons, you're going to be feeling constant pressure to budget income tightly. That never goes away. You'll always think, ooh, I have to be really careful about my spending, to curb your spending. And the third bullet point down, you will always live in fear of financial reversals that could suddenly plunge any person back into poverty. So this is your choice. For the vast majority of Americans, you can have low effort and low income, and there's a price to pay for that. Or you can have high effort and not necessarily high income, just income. And that still is kind of scary. But that is where most of us Christians live all of our lives. That's how it is. We talked about colliding with the reality of low income and problems in our world. So, for example, in 2018, the Psychiatric Times Journal talked about this. Poverty in childhood is associated with, so you want low income, here's where you go, okay? Poverty in childhood is associated with lower school achievement, worse cognitive, behavioral, and attention-related outcomes, higher rates of delinquency, higher rates of depression and anxiety, and higher rates of almost every psychiatric disorder in adulthood. Say, well, I'm just going to have low income and lots of free time. All right, well, this is what your children are going to face in most instances. At the bottom of that slide, poverty in adulthood is linked to depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, psychological distress, and suicide. Say, well, I'm just going to have low income. I'm going to be a low-effort slacker and have low income and be happy about it. Well, okay, but you should know that most people who have low energy, low effort, low income are not happy about it. Interesting, in 2020, the NBC News in Miami, Florida, carried this article. And of course, this is not very long ago, right? The person living near the Brickwell Metro Station in Miami will live more than 10 years longer, on average, of course, more than 10 years longer than the person living 8 minutes away in the area near the Overton Metro train station. So the median income for the Brickell neighborhood is $80,000, and those people can expect to live to be 81 years old. But 8 minutes away in the Overtown area, which is a welfare area, those people can expect to live to be only 71. Now, there is a lot that goes into that. You know, there are a lot of layers there, but the biggest, most obvious layer is that one area has a lot more money than the other area. And they're living in a much more positive environment than the other area. So you say, well, I just want to have low income. I just don't want to worry about it. Well, there's a price to pay for that. And this is not coming from Christian voices. These are just from social scientists. All right. What we are saying is that your personal well-being, sometimes even your survival, is directly tied to your work ethic. So we start in the book of Genesis. This is just after Adam and Eve have fallen into sin, and now all creation is going to fight against them. In the curse that we read about in Genesis 3:17, God said to Adam, "The ground is cursed. In sorrow you shall eat from it all the days of your life. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread." You see highlighted there sorrow and sweat. Now there had always been work in paradise. God himself worked and rested on the seventh day. Adam was a gardener, and you could imagine he was enjoying his gardening, same as you probably enjoy gardening, at least to some degree, or other kinds of pleasant work. Adam probably thought, now I'm going to move this rock over here, and I'm going to set up a rock garden, and I want to make the creek cut through here, and I'll have a pond. And he's probably working things out creatively just the way he wanted to. Work as many hours a day as he wants to. He doesn't have to work. Nobody's holding a gun to his head. It's pleasant work. It's creative work, and everybody likes to create things, right? And so that is happening before sin comes into the world. But now with the curse, work is related to sorrow and sweat. Not much fun, right? But that's the way it's going to be. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 10, the Apostle Paul says, "Even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, neither should he eat. And if any man does not obey," this is a church discipline passage, "and if any man does not obey our word by this epistle, note that man, have no company with him, that he may be ashamed." Now we're dealing here with some very politically incorrect ideas. Do you see what's here? This says shame. we are trying to shame people. Like in American culture, like, you can't say that. It's like, well, I didn't say it. The Apostle Paul said it, and he was under inspiration from the Holy Spirit. So, you know, you write him a letter if you don't like it. But there it is. So we're talking about intentionally shaming people and shunning them. Like, what? You cannot shun people. But that's what it says. Mark that man, pay attention to that man, and have no company with him. Let him know that he is not fitting in with the biblical work ethic, and he should be ashamed. Like, wow. So we're talking about shaming and shunning and even withholding charity. So Paul says, oh, he won't work. He could work. He's perfectly able, but he won't work. Oh, well, then don't give him food. If he won't work, he gets no food. One time, a member of my family was arguing with my dad and said, I just don't want to work 8 hours a day. I just don't. Dad said, fine. Do you want to eat? I mean, you don't have to work 8 hours a day, but you're going to have to work if you want to eat according to that text. So we're talking about shaming, shunning, and withholding charity. That's a pretty big deal. In 1 Timothy 5:8, if any does not provide for his own family, and especially for those in his own house, he's denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So it's not just about your own food. You're supposed to be taking care of your family, the people around you, the people under your roof. In Romans 12:11, do not be lazy in business, but be fervent, industrious, diligent in spirit, serving the Lord. In Proverbs 6:6, we have the beginning of, you know, the ant Proverbs. There are two great ones. Go to the ant. Go over there and look at your science experiments. Go to your ant farm. Go to the ant, you slacker. Consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler. Again, nobody's forcing the ant to do this. She provides her food in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. How long will you sleep, O slacker? When will you arise out of your sleep? Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of your hands to sleep. So your poverty shall come as one that travels, and your scarcity as an armed man. You're going to be in trouble because poverty comes like a bandit. It steals from you. In chapter 30, verse 25, we love the Bible's colorful language. The ants are a people not strong. I never really thought of the ants as a people, actually. But the ants are a people not strong. Yet they prepare their food in the summer, and that's true. In most places, ants sort of hibernate in the winter. They get kind of slow and they store up their food and they don't try to move around very much. And they save their sustenance. And so the ants are a good example of our work ethic. In Proverbs 24, verse 30, an extended text. I went by the field of the lazy man and by the vineyard of the man void of understanding. Is that interesting that laziness and foolishness are coupled together here? The man void of understanding. And look, it was all grown over with thorns and nettles had covered the face of it. And the stone wall of it was broken down. And then I saw and considered it. Well, I looked at it and I received instruction. Here's my instruction. Here's my life lesson. A little more sleep, a little more slumber, a little more folding of your hands to sleep. And same thing as before. Your poverty shall come as one that travels and your scarcity as an armed man. Here comes a bandit to take away all your stuff because you like to sleep too much. All of these proverbs in rapid succession. Do you see a man diligent in his business? He'll stand before kings. He shall not stand before inconsequential men. Be diligent to know the state of your flocks. Pay attention and look well to your herds. Laziness casts a person into a deep sleep, and an idle soul shall suffer hunger. Wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished, but he that gathers by labor shall increase. The payback of a man's hand shall be returned to him. The lazy man does not roast what he took in hunting, but the substance, the personal possessions of a diligent man are precious to him. The soul of the lazy desires and has nothing, but the soul of the diligent shall be made fat. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. His grandchildren are helped by his industriousness. So we're finding that in the book of Proverbs, you have to work hard. And if you don't work hard, it just shows that you're foolish and immoral. Business researchers have suggested that there are three things actually that are going to impact your profession, your career, your income. The first one, in no particular order, is hard work. What kind of effort do you put into your work? The second one is your relationships, your social network. You're soon going to find out that most people don't get their lifetime jobs from filling out resumes and sending them off to strangers. Most people are getting their favorite jobs by people they know recommending them for those favorite jobs. That's mission critical. When you know somebody, then good things happen. And thirdly, what we are calling lucky or unlucky breaks, but you know I use that term from time to time only to talk about providence, the things you have no control over, but of course God has control over. Things like parenting. Here's the most important rule for success. This is true. Pick the right parents. But you can't pick your parents, right? God has to do that. Parenting, your birthplace. You know, if you're born in sub-Saharan Africa, you're probably going to have a harder time than if you're born with Wall Street parents in this country, right? Social circle. Depends on what social circle you're born into and also what social circle you cultivate over the course of your lifetime. Things that are in your DNA, natural talent, natural IQ, natural beauty, health. These are all things that contribute to your career success and even your income. Now, in all of these, you see, you have substantial say in how hard you work. That's very much up to you. Of course, it's not entirely up to you because God could take away your health and you'll be flat on your back and work not at all. But you have substantial say in your work effort, your work ethic. Relationships. Again, you have some say in this. You can try to cultivate relationships. You can reach out to people. Of course, there are many things you have no say over. Like when you were born, all the people that came around and said you were a beautiful baby, you had nothing to do with that. You have nothing to say about that. Those are your parents' friends and just nice people who happen to be there. But that's not on you. But relationships you do have some control over, right? And so you should cultivate such relationships. And of course, you have almost no control over many of the things in the third category here. That's why we're calling them lucky breaks. You won the lottery when it comes to DNA. You are very intelligent. You have a great IQ. You're beautiful. You have something to say about health and fitness and how beautiful you are, but you are not entirely in control of any of those things. And so you see, you have control mostly over your work ethic. Those things you can control largely. Rachel Simmons is a best-selling author, and I don't think she makes any claims about being a believer. But she says the humbling, brutal, messy reality of life is that you can do everything in your power and still fail. That's true. We keep telling our children, well, if you work hard enough, anything is possible. And of course, that's foolish. It becomes a mantra that we repeat over and over again, but that's not true. If you do not have the IQ, you cannot do certain things. Hard work can make up for so many things. But if you don't have the body, you cannot be an NBA basketball player. You can work as hard as you want, and it will never happen. And the quixotic belief, she says, that success is always within your grasp is what the University of Chicago professor Lauren Berlant calls cruel optimism. You have to quit telling people that they can do anything, they can achieve anything. That's not true. It's cruel optimism. And when they fail, then they feel terrible about it. Piers Steele, once again, professor, I don't know that he makes any claims about being a Christian, University of Calgary. He says, hard work beats talent, but only if talent doesn't work hard. So a natural athlete who hates sports, you could probably outplay him. But if he's a talented athlete and he works hard, you lose, unless you are also a talented, hardworking athlete. Says Pierre Steele, most of the time, you're going to end up competing against rivals with one of these attributes, talent or hard work, but not both. He goes on. People who are exceptionally talented are exceptionally rare. But people who work hard are pretty rare, too. So you can just see this, like in high school sports and high school academics. Like, this guy has a really high IQ, but he doesn't do his homework. I can beat him. And you say, well, this guy doesn't have as high an IQ as I do, but every day to him is like a final exam, and he's going to beat me. So people who work hard are pretty rare, too. You can outperform, says Peter Steele. You can outperform the smartest individuals as long as you work hard and they don't. If you have chosen a career where only the very, very best succeed, then you better be born with a lot of talent. You can be a pretty good track athlete in high school, but that doesn't mean you can do it in college. And when you get to college, that doesn't mean you're going to the Olympics. At that level, they are very, very talented, and they are working very, very hard. And if you're not going to do that, you can't keep up. And at the bottom of this slide, those with natural aptitude and the willingness to put in the effort are as rare as diamonds. And that's pretty nifty, because some of you have been gifted with pretty special IQ, beauty, health, fitness, whatever. And if you put in the effort, then you are as rare as a diamond. That's pretty great. And a lot of Christians aren't giving the Lord their best, and they should reconsider that. A lot of times, as the old saying goes, hard work works when nothing else works. And that's true a lot of times. That's not the only thing to keep in mind, but that's a good thing. Hard work works many times when nothing else will work. And a lot of times you just push through it by working hard. There's the 10,000-hour rule. That's very helpful. It comes from the business world, and it has some value, not as much value as some people might think. But the idea is that if you practice anything for 10,000 hours, you'll get pretty good at it. Then you'll be among the best in the world. So if you are a computer programmer geek and you sit there and you practice your programming for 20 hours a week for 10 years, you're going to be a pretty good computer programmer. If you want to go to the gym 20 hours a week for 10 years, you'll have a pretty nice physique. If you want to play the violin and you practice 20 hours a week for 10 years, you'll be a pretty good violin player. That's the 10,000-hour rule. That really makes sense for a lot of us. But that's not everything, right? People have researched this pretty carefully now. They found out that deliberate practice maybe accounts for 21% of success in music, because some people are just natural musicians. You know the story of Van Cliburn, piano player? His mom was a piano teacher. She's doing piano lessons in her house. She dismisses her student, goes out the front door. 3-year-old Van Cliburn gets on the piano bench, starts playing what that person was practicing, and the mom thinks, oh, my student came back for some reason. Pokes her head out of the hallway and finds her 3-year-old son playing the piano. That's talent, not practice. Of course, he did practice. And when you have talent and you practice, then you're a diamond. But practice accounts for about 21% of the success in music, 18% of success in sports, 4% of success in education, about 1% of success for professions, because, you know, most of our jobs aren't that demanding. You know, I'm a truck driver. How much practice do I need? Not to say truck drivers shouldn't practice. We want you guys to practice, and we're all going to practice right along with you. All right. Bill Gates is obviously an exceptionally intelligent and determined person, but how can he do what he did? Well, he attended an elite private school in Seattle. The parents did a fundraiser rummage sale in 1968 and decided to build at their elite private school a computer center, and they bought a state-of-the-art time-sharing computer terminal that was connected with the computer mainframe in downtown Seattle. Bill Gates and a few of his friends are there at exactly this time, and it basically became their clubhouse. Not the whole school's clubhouse, Bill Gates and his few friends' clubhouse. And nobody else even cared. It's 1968. You know, we don't care. But Bill Gates and a few of his geeky friends care. And you see, as he puts it there in yellow, this computer equipment was housed in this funny little room that we subsequently took control of. Well, okay, so yes, he is intelligent, he's very industrious, and he's also very lucky. Now, of course, God was in that, right? Not really luck, but providence. Biblically, success, accomplishments, financial assets are all going to come from this alchemy of one-of-a-kind, one-off, personalized mixtures of these three things. Birth providences. What were you born with in the area of IQ and talent and beauty and physical ability and relational intelligence, emotional intelligence? It's just like in the DNA. And hard work, which includes cultivating relational networks and cultivating your own personal relational skills. That matters. And lifetime providences. These are things all through your life that you were given, the parents you were given, your birthplace, your physical surroundings, your social opportunities, your spiritual sensitivity, answered prayers. Sometimes the answered prayers of others. You didn't even do that. You just won the lottery because somebody else was praying for you. I'm using lottery metaphorically, right? I don't really want you to win the lottery. Spiritual sensitivity, answered prayers, calling, all these inborn factors of IQ and natural talent, and all the relationship magic. You can't make somebody like you. Every once in a while, some adult just fixes his eyes on you when you're a kid and decides that he's going to help you. You could never make that magic happen. God has to make that happen. And that happens all through your life. Somebody just says, you know, for whatever reason, I like you and I'm going to help you out. And that's just so wonderful. But that's God doing that. It's a lifetime providence. Even if someday automation, and it could happen this way, if someday automation and very, very efficient farming practices make it possible for us to have 3-day work weeks with 4 days off, that might really happen someday. Or if our government decides to do a universal basic income, that basically means you have enough food and a comfortable place to live without working or only doing sort of the Star Trek thing. I work because I want to work, kind of going back to Adam and Eve in the garden. I want to do this. If that happens someday, even then, as Christians, we would all still work really, really hard. In spite of our income, in spite of no longer a need to work 5 or 6 days a week, all of us who are Christians will still work really, really hard. All God's people are busy. And all God's people will always be busy because it's what we are. And it's because of our second point here. My ability to love God and others is directly tied to my own hard effort. Even loving people is going to require you to work and even work hard. 2 Corinthians 5:9. The Apostle Paul here says, wherefore we labor. And there, when he uses that term labor, it is to strive after honor. The idea is philos, I love, and tamao, honor. I love honor. So he says, we labor, we work hard for a trophy is what we're talking about here, for an eternal crown. We labor that whether present or absent, we may be accepted of God. And accepted there means that we would be good pleasing to God. We're really working for this trophy, but it's not the trophy we care about. It's to be pleasing to our wonderful Savior. So we labor, we're really into this. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive for the things done. See, it's what you do that counts. We don't want to overemphasize works in the Christian faith, but we don't want to underemphasize them either. When you stand before the Lord someday as a believer at the judgment seat of Christ, the basis of your reward, your rank and reward for all of eternity is going to be, yes, on your character, but your character is also going to be reflected in what you do. And so Paul says we're going to be judged for what we have done in the body according to what we have done, whether it's good or bad. So you don't want to demean that if the Lord is emphasizing it. In 1 Corinthians 9:26, same idea. Paul says, I therefore so run. I mean, I'm working at this. I'm running. I'm not walking. I run, not as uncertainly. I know what I'm doing. I have a goal. I have a determined finish line here. I run, not as uncertainly, so I fight. I run and I fight. Those are words that express effort. I fight, not as one who beats the air. I'm not karate chopping the wind here. I'm going after something. I keep under my body. I am lifting my body because my body wants to stay in my lazy boy chair. So I get under it and push it up. I keep under my body and bring it into subjection. Like, straighten up. You know, you gotta work. Lest by any means when I have preached to others, I myself should be unapproved. And so you see the motivation here. And now he's not particularly talking about career and finance and income, right? He's talking about serving the Lord in a very special way. Luke 19:12. Jesus told that to his disciples just as a lesson to all disciples, not just the 12. He said, a certain noble man went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. And he called his 10 servants and he delivered them 10 pounds. And he said unto them, do business till I come. See, the Lord wasn't concerned with his disciples making a lot of money at Microsoft. He wanted them to do business, his business, until he returns. And you know the rest of the story, that one fellow went and he gained, you know, 10 times as much. And the Lord complimented him. And one fellow came back and said, I didn't even try because I was afraid. I didn't even try. And the Lord said to him, that was not a good job. Take away everything he has and give it to the others who did a good job. And so do business till I come. And we're not talking about your career. We're talking about loving God and loving others. In Matthew 9:36, when Jesus saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion on them because they fainted and were scattered abroad as sheep having no shepherd. And he said to his disciples, the harvest is truly plenteous, but the laborers are few. Pray therefore the Lord of the harvest that he will send forth laborers into his harvest. There's so much work to do for Jesus. In 1 Corinthians 3:8, now he who plants and he who waters are one, and every man shall receive his own reward according to his own what? Labor. And once again, in Greek, that term labor is synonymous with fatigue. He's going to receive his own reward according to his own fatigue. He's working hard. His own labor. For we are laborers together with God. You are God's husbandry, God's farming, God's agriculture. You are God's building. We're gardening and we're building you. In 1 Corinthians 15:58, therefore, my brethren, just all of us, therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as you know that your labor, and there it is again, your fatigue in the Lord is not in vain. Sometime back, I heard about a church in our area. One of the pastors there said, yeah, you know, we got this idea that all the church people were working really hard and we were concerned about burnout. And so at one of the Sunday school teachers' meetings, we told them, look, if you're having a hard time maintaining a cheerful attitude about this, you don't know if you really want to teach anymore, you don't really know if you want to work with children anymore, we want to leave you a big exit because we want the people who are working in our ministries to be cheerful about it. We want them to be happy. And so if you feel like you're burning out and you need a break, we want to give you that opportunity. He said it was the worst mistake of his life because everybody wanted a break. But see, of course, everybody wants a break. And you don't want to be grouchy about it. You know, you want to be a cheerful giver. But fatigue is what we do. If we didn't have to work 5 days a week or 6 days a week to put food on the table, we Christians would still work 5 or 6 days a week, working hard and getting fatigued because of the cause of Christ. It's what we do. Philippians 4:3. And I ask you also, true yoke fellow, help those women who labored. And that's interesting. It's got the word athlete in it. Soon, athleto. You hear athlete in that, right? Soon means together. They athleted together with me. And athletes work pretty hard, unless it's a golf team. All right. I ask you also, true yoke fellow, help those women who athleted with me. In the gospel with Clement, also with other my fellow laborers whose names are in the book of life. Help them. They're working hard. In 1 Thessalonians 1:2. We give thanks to God always for you all, making mention of you in our prayers, remembering without ceasing your work of faith. And there it is again, your labor, your fatigue of love. Isn't that interesting? The fatigue of love. Why are you so tired? Because I've been loving so many people today. I'm just so tired. The fatigue of love. Hebrews 6:10, God is not unrighteous to forget your work. And here it is again, your fatigue of love. Twice in the New Testament, your fatigue of love, which you have shown toward his name, and that you have ministered to the saints and still are ministering to the saints. You just keep going. You're serving the people. In Revelation 14:3, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, from their fatigue, and their works do follow them. It's hard to serve the Lord. We're always going to serve the Lord, and we're going to serve the Lord to the point of fatigue. That doesn't mean that you make yourself sick, but it does mean that there's going to be an element of fatigue and sometimes huge elements of fatigue in following Jesus, and that's okay. James 1:27 says, pure religion undefiled before God is this, to visit the orphans and the widows in their affliction. If you didn't have to work an hour in your life to put food on the table, it was all just there and you never had to work again, you should still work hard for Jesus. And there are all these things to do. If I never worked again, I would still work hard visiting the lost, visiting the sick and elderly, doing yard work and handyman work for the sick and elderly. I would master the word. I would meet for worship and meet for mentoring and meet for hospitality. And I would reach out to as many children as I could. And I would serve the lost and serve the saved in every way that I could imagine. And that if I never had to go to work again to put food on the table. This never ends. It never goes away. I've shared with you before this story, which I love very much, and this is how we're going to bring it to a close today. You know, I was raised in the south suburbs of Chicago, and this is part of the lore of Chicago. The worst shipwreck that took place on the Great Lakes took place in September of 1860, just before the Civil War era, right? The Lady Elgin was carrying almost 400 passengers. We didn't have a passenger manifest, so we're not sure. It might have actually been carrying more than 400, but about 400 passengers. They were rammed by another ship at 2:30 in the morning in September. And early September in Chicago isn't brutally cold, but it's not pleasant. And Lake Michigan is always cold, always cold. By the time the sun rose that September morning, a little after 6 o'clock in the morning, everybody on the shore knew that there had been a shipwreck at Northwestern University, which was a Christian university. There's a ministerial student named Edward Spencer, who is also a lifeguard. And he ran to the shore, and he looked out, and he saw between 300 and 400 people floating out there. And he's a trained lifeguard. Somebody had a big rope, a long rope. Edward tied it onto his waist, gave the end to his friend, and went out and grabbed a person, and the friend tugged them both back to shore. He took the rope again, waterlogged rope, a couple hundred feet long, and he went out and he grabbed another person, and he did it again and again until 10 people were saved. At this time, he was so exhausted and so hypothermic from 70-degree water on a September morning. And somebody built a fire on the shore, and so he went over and he warmed himself. And then he thought, I have to go out again. And remember, more than 300 people are going to die this day. He said, I have to go out again. So out he goes, and he saved 5 more people, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 people now he saved. And now he is totally hypothermic. He's been in that water a long time, hours of saving people. And again, they drag him over to the fire, and his friends wonder if he himself is going to die. He can't even function anymore. He's warming himself by the fire, and as he sits by the fire, he's looking at the lake, and he sees this guy doing everything he can to keep his wife from drowning. Edward is so touched by this. He said, fellows, I have to go out again. They said, you can't even walk. Never mind, swim out there. He says, I have to go out there. And he went out there and he got the man and his wife and brought him back. And so he had saved 17 people over the course of 6 hours, most of the time in that brutally cold Lake Michigan temperature. Well, after 6 hours of this, he is literally delirious. I mean, his body is shutting down. They carry him back to the infirmary at the university, and he sleeps and sleeps and sleeps. His brother Will is right there with him. And when Edward wakes up, the first thing he says is, Will, did I do my best? And Will said, you saved 17 people. Of course, 300 died. You saved 17 people, Edward. Nobody else did that. And he said, yes, but do you think I did my very best? He said, if I could only have saved just one more. And by the way, the hypothermia had damaged his nervous system, so he would never be right for the rest of his life. He had done everything humanly possible. 48 years later, on November 8th, 1908, R.A. Torrey is preaching in Los Angeles, which is a long ways from Chicago. And R.A. Torrey told his audience the story as I have just now told you. Somebody sitting on the platform behind R.A. Torrey came up and whispered in his ear, he said, Edward Spencer is here in the congregation tonight. Torrey said, is that right? He's here? Edward Spencer, are you here? And the guy got off the platform. He walked down and he grabbed Edward Spencer and he brought him up on the platform. And everybody just started cheering. They gave him a standing ovation. And in those days, they waved handkerchiefs, you know, when they were happy. And they were waving their handkerchiefs and cheering for this guy. If you never had to work another day in your life for food and shelter, you should live your life like Edward Spencer lived his life. Is the biblical ethic of work essential for my life? Jesus said in John 9:4, I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day, because the night comes when no man can work. It's a saying I hear amongst celebrities from time to time. It says, you know, we're not going to sleep now. You can sleep when you die. Well, I mean, that's terrible theology. But the time is coming when no man can work. If there's anything nice you wanted to do for Jesus, if there's anything you wanted to do in your life that really mattered for eternity, this is the time to do it. And if you say, but I'm tired, well, you know what? You can rest when you die. You won't sleep, but you can rest when you die. How about if we do our work now and then we have all eternity to talk about it?